Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here. The following audio was recorded live at San Francisco Comic-Con. This is our Jack Kirby on Civil Rights panel, and I had the pleasure of speaking on Kirby and constitutional law with my good friend Michael Dennis, who I went to law school with, and his wife, Crystal Swanson. Both are attorneys outside of Modesto, and it was great fun to talk with them at San Francisco Comic-Con. Enjoy.
Start. Do we have any attorneys in the room with us?
I know there's at least one. So, all right.
That's pretty awesome that this group of people is coming out on a Saturday night at 8:30 for something like constitutional law as it applies to comics.
So let's talk about Jack Kirby. The agenda will hit many of the big comics that Kirby helped create. Captain America, X-Men, Fantastic Four, and a little Hulk. There's a lot more. His career was immense. He touched on many issues. We couldn't even get into the New Gods or whether Mr. Miracle is a refugee. There's a lot of great stuff to talk about, and this will be the tip of the iceberg focusing on the Timely and Marvel days. So first up, let's do the countdown to Captain America 1. And it's important to look at what happened prior to Captain America coming out in March of 1941. I'm a history geek, and one of the things that we wanted to look at was what happened in the 1930s. Well, the United States wanted to stay out of war and wanted to just let Europe burn down. And we passed neutrality acts, thinking that we could just legislate our way out of conflict. And we passed three of them. And the ones from 1935, which were spearheaded by Senator Gerald Nye, took the position that any part of the world that was engaged in conflict was the forbidden zone. And thus, the United States could not send arms, ammunition, or anything that would support war in belligerent countries, and restricted travel of Americans to those countries. So by the time Hitler starts marching across Europe, we have Americans willing to risk their own citizenship crossing illegally into Canada to go to England to fight in the RAF in the Battle of Britain. And it just goes to show that while we had this push and this isolationist impulse, we had Americans willing to risk their lives and nationality in order to fight fascism. Let's take a step at how this was applied. So there's case law dealing with the neutrality acts. And one of the situations that happened was a ship was on its way to Norway, and Norway gets run over by Germany. The ship turns around, goes back to New York, and the sailors sue for breach of contract because they weren't going to get paid because they didn't deliver their supplies to Norway. And the court said, no recovery. They didn't breach the contract. They just couldn't go there because war broke out while you were on the way to Norway. And that's a really crappy, evil position, but that's what was happening with the application of the Neutrality Acts. You also had U.S. citizens take the Oxford Oath. People in Great Britain were taking the Oxford Pledge, which was, under no circumstances will I fight for king and country. And on April 12, 1935, 60,000 college students across the United States took the Oxford Oath saying they would never fight for the United States, even if the United States was attacked. This was not the predominant view of the greatest generation. We also had the worst summer camps in world history because a Nazi organization started in 1936 with German Americans to perpetuate Nazi beliefs in the United States to bring the Nazi Party to our country. And they were called the Bund. And they had 70 chapters, and they were running Nazi summer camps where U.S. children dressed in Nazi-type uniforms and did military maneuvers because it was sick, perverse, and evil. And their membership at the beginning ranged around 5,000 and then got up to 25,000 members. They decided to go big in February of 1939, and they had a rally in Madison Square Garden where 20,000 Nazis who were U.S. citizens showed up to wave their flags of support for the Führer and referring to President Washington as America's first fascist. Sick and twisted. Now, while there are 20,000 American Nazis being evil, there were 50,000 New Yorkers outside of Madison Square Garden giving them the middle finger. So the fact that we had sick, perverse people, there were more people lining up outside to go, not here, and you were wrong, and this might seem very familiar. Yeah, so here is the abridged timeline of key events that happened in the 30s leading up to the U.S. involvement in World War I. We have Roosevelt elected in November of 1932. Hitler comes to power in January of 33. The beginning of concentration camps are starting to be built in 1933. You have the Oxford Oath, you have the Neutrality Act, you have the Boon, you have the next Neutrality Act, you have the Japanese invasion of China, and the list goes on. And then September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland. We have the shadow war while Europe gears up for the fighting that starts in April of 1940. Then we have the events that would lead to Dunkirk and France falling, the Battle of Britain. Then we have the Draft Act that passes in the United States by a grand total of one vote. Even though war is looming and the United States is threatened, you had General George C. Marshall lobbying congressmen in person to vote for a military draft, and it only passes by one vote. Captain America number one then comes out. And when you think of the despicable behavior that's happening within the United States, you think of the suffering that's happening in Europe, the fact that the first issue of a comic book comes out written by two Jewish men with the character punching Hitler across the face is brave and bold, and it's inspiring, and it sold a million copies. That doesn't happen today. And when you look at Joe Simon and Jack Kirby's beliefs and who they were, they came up with an inspirational character when the country was torn. Do we stand against fascism, or do we get on board with them? And they took the position, we are not getting on board. And there were protesters outside of Timely Comics. There were threats to Simon and Kirby. And New York Mayor LaGuardia called them and offered police protection to make sure they were safe. That's the impact that Captain America 1 had with Cap punching Hitler.
And along those lines, one of the last interviews, I was watching YouTube last week on Kirby, and someone asked him, well, why did you write Captain America? His response was, how could I not? Everyone was so pro-America at this time. The problem was people were so pro-America, it was, we're America first, we're not going to Europe. And so he wanted to change that. And along with what LaGuardia calling, they got another call saying, hey, people are calling and threatening our publication. His response was, tell me what phone booth they're calling from. That's just the kind of guy he was, and he wanted something to be done. And when I first saw this timeline, I always assumed World War II was going on when Captain America came out.
I did too.
And then I realized, no, this is months before Pearl Harbor that this is being written.
It's brave, and it's inspiring, and these motifs go throughout all of Kirby's career. So let's break down the first issues of Captain America 1, and they're a little surprising because they are simplistic. There's right and wrong. And there's some legal issues that jump out because these were written for kids. And when lawyers read it, we get into doing legal analysis pretty quickly. So first off, let's talk about Cap, who is in the army, conducting espionage and fighting German spies.
Well, like Josh has said, Captain Kirby has a very strong sense of what's right and what's wrong, but the comic is a little questionable legally. So the Posse Comitatus can be found at 18 United States Code 1385. It says that you cannot use the United States Air Force or Army, basically as a police force, without congressional approval. Now, Captain America is the alter ego of Steve Rogers, and Steve Rogers joined the Army. He gets involved in an experiment. He's given a secret serum that turns him into the ultimate fighter, the ultimate soldier. And again, you've got to think about the time period that this is going on. We're not quite at war, but it's looming. We're almost there. This is around March of 1941. So once he becomes Captain America, he's sent out to catch spies, which sounds awfully copish. You know, it sounds like something the police would do. And for that, it's questionable. You know, the mission is clearly to support domestic security, which is something that you would expect a police force to do. Now, Steve Rogers was never actually discharged from the Army. So Captain America, being the same person, is also never discharged from the Army. We have no indication anywhere that there was that Congress was convened and passed the act to make this okay. So I think, yeah, they're using the Army as a police force, which is a violation of the Posse Comitatus.
Yeah, it's really confusing because when you look at it, and we do our scanned in panels from the first issue and from the Marvel Masterworks, and the Espionage Act of 1917 prohibits, you know, spycraft. Like, we passed that during World War I to protect our secrets. And we have Cap going out, punching bad guys. And again, look at the Kirby art. Like, this is, it's not the linear comic that many people just did with squares in the newspapers. We have the panel divided. There's a lot going on. But he's clearly out there catching spies.
As an agent of the Army.
Yeah, and it gets really weird. After he becomes Captain America, like, the FBI is watched the experiment with Erickson, but his CO doesn't know that he's also Captain America. There's no one that he's reporting to in the early issues. It's really weird because you can't go, is he a vigilante? Is he working under the auspices of the FBI? There's no explanation because Simon and Kirby didn't write it that way. But for us, we look at it and go like, how's this legal?
What's fun about being an attorney is I can argue the other side. So every Supreme Court case you ever see, there was someone on the losing end that was absolutely convinced that they were right. And so when you look at like, well, this was a 5-4 decision, that means if we change Supreme Court justices, suddenly that's a 4-5 decision, the law is completely changed. So when you see those hearings come on television, don't ignore them. They're actually really important. Because now we have an issue of World War II comes to an end and Captain America gets frozen. And he gets thawed and it's supposed to be around present day. I mean, if you watch the movies, that's when he joins the Avengers. And we've had a couple more acts come around since then. We've had the Insurrection Act, which has been since modified. But that was designed for the president to be able to call on federal forces to quell rebellions and other acts that he thought the states couldn't handle themselves. That's since been expanded to cover terrorism and other conduct, so you can see it around national disasters. Saw on the news that some destroyers are now entering the Gulf of Mexico to help out in Texas because they don't believe that the state of Texas has the resources. So that's something that can happen along the lines. More concerning, and it's something we could spend an entire hour on, is the National Defense Authorization Bill of 2012, which allowed the military to detain suspected terrorists indefinitely, which kind of sounds like police work, that if you're detaining terrorists here on U.S. soil, and it's the military that gets to detain them indefinitely.
Issues that we've noticed in the comics, where when Cap goes out and captures someone and subdues a bad guy, you know, they have discussions with, leave them for the FBI. So there's definitely a handoff to law enforcement, but he's not affecting arrests, and it's not clean, and it's still being done in secret, which, again, March of 1941, and it was written around December of 1940. So just to give this the historical background.
And it's a little bit questionable, too, you know, because during the time that the experiment was going on with Steve Rogers, the FBI was there, you know, so it becomes a question, if he's acting on behalf of the Army, not okay, but if he's acting on behalf of the FBI, that's probably okay. We just don't know for sure which one that it is. That's where it gets crazy.
And we can't ask Simon or Kirby what they wanted it to be because they're not here. But let's talk about one of the things that kind of disturbed me about the first comic is he goes out and we see what could be called an enhanced interrogation because Cap grabs a guy by the throat and says, "Now, isn't that just too bad? This calls for a little tightening of the windpipe." And Mike, could you help us understand this?
Okay.
And one thing to think about as we're going through this is the very first episode issue has Hitler being punched in the face. Just think if Captain America came out today, who would be punched in the face? Would it be, I don't know, a certain leader from North Korea, someone that's running a drug cartel? Because Kirby had that strong sense of right and wrong, just not so much what the legal code was to implement that. So you have to look at this issue. The backstory. Apparently, when you're in the Army and you want to go out and nine on the town, you go to a lecture. So Captain America and Bucky decide to go to the theater to see this admiral speak. Little did they know, the greatly named Agent Number 5, or just Number 5, a Nazi who's tasked with killing the high-ranking military officials of our country, got there first, killed Admiral Perkins, and as the curtain goes up, people see the body lying there.
Yeah, hanging, like crucified.
So, Captain, enraged, decides, I'm going to go chase after him, but first I must change into my Captain America outfit. I'm in hot pursuit, as must Bucky. They chase him down, capture him, little choking to the windpipe, and it looks like it works, because he's about to talk. Unfortunately, he gets shot right before he talks. So the question comes, is this torture? And there's a very specific definition of torture, and it's been tweaked. The one Josh has put onto the slide is from 2002. That one came out with defenses to torture. If you had necessity or self-defense, you're allowed to torture him. 2004 comes around, they're like, no, we need to get rid of those defenses. There is no justification for torture.
Not okay.
No, it's not okay. Illegal.
So the element torture can be intentional or threatened infliction of severe physical or mental pain, the administration of mind-altering drugs, the threat of imminent death, or threatening those against another person. All count as torture. But it's not your run-of-the-mill torture. This is the most grave versions of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. So when Barry Zito used to take the mound for the Giants back in their last run to the World Series, and everyone said, oh, this is torture. We're never going to make it. That's not what they're talking about. It has to rise to the most grave levels. So then you get into the issue of, well, is this just a coerced confession? He wasn't really looking for a confession. He wanted to know who sent him. And yeah, this would be a coerced confession because it's no longer voluntary when you can't breathe. And when you can't breathe, you tend to say anything a person wants you to. So those don't stand up in the court of law at all.
Yeah, Burr Baker's Captain America would not be doing this. And so our values, we wouldn't tolerate this in comics today, and let's not talk about Secret Empire, but there's a lot there from March of 1941. Let's jump to 1963, and in September is the first issue of The X-Men. And rightfully so. So it's this golden age of Marvel where we have all these titles coming out, starting with Fantastic Four, and then Avengers, a bunch of other characters, and September of 63, we get The X-Men. Well, here's the mission of the X-Men, where we have Jean Grey being introduced to Professor X, and they're very altruistic. And it's very Kirby And yes, Lee and Kirby did this together, and it's tough to tell who did what because it's not like they kept notes, but it's a collaboration between the two of them, and this is their values. And we have Professor X saying not all of them want to help, speaking about mutants. Some want to destroy the human race and wish to destroy it. Some feel that mutants should be the real rulers of Earth. It is our job to protect mankind from those, from the evil mutants. And let's take a look at Magneto's introduction and the same issue. You know, the human race no longer deserves dominion over the planet Earth. The day of the mutants is upon us. And we have the quote, to make Homo sapiens bow to Homo superior. Kirby fought in World War II. He dealt with people who thought they were the master race. And that's the beginning spin of the X-Men, that Magneto isn't the Magneto that we think of today. In the early issues, he sounds pretty fascist, that we don't have the backstory that we now know, that if you watch X-Men First Class, I'm down with him hunting Nazis for 90 minutes. That would be a fine movie by my taste. But that's not how he's introduced. And the X-Men are welcomed with open arms for the first seven issues when they're out in public helping people. It changes a little later on. But let's talk about child endangerment.
Now, there's comics for adults, and there's comics for teens and kids. And there are a ton of superheroes that are actually children. And like Enhanced Interrogation, the rules for child endangerment are also very specific. You know, it looks cool to kick butt in a comic book, and I think everyone likes to see someone their age doing something cool. But when it comes to a child, child endangerment is defined as causing or allowing a child to unjustifiably suffer pain, not sure when it's justified, to actually suffer an injury or to be placed in a dangerous situation. So the child doesn't actually have to suffer an injury for child endangerment to apply. Probably okay for the adults to train them. Probably not okay to send them out to fight crime.
Yeah, but let's take another view, because we want the young mutants to learn how their powers work so they can safely be in society, they can know their limits. So is this just really aggressive PE?
No. aggressive PE, there are standards that are set out that coaches have to follow, and they're issued by the National Association for Sports and Physical Education. They include such things as you have to participate in a safe environment, you have to use safe equipment, you have to be matched in terms of age and ability. You have to be sensitive to the well-being of the student that you're coaching or training. Now, the slide shows Angel, who is 16 at the time. So in some states, Angel can't even drive yet, and he's being trained to fight who knows what. You know, in the slide, he is being monitored health-wise, so that's a plus. But when you send him out to fight crime, you don't know where it's going to be, you don't know who he's going to fight. You have no idea, but can probably assume he won't be matched in terms of age and ability. So is their training okay as aggressive PE? Probably not. You know, it's definitely child endangerment. Again, it's probably okay for them to get trained by adults, but not necessarily to go out and fight crime.
Yeah, because Professor X sending out child soldiers, that we wouldn't read that comic. But we did, and we loved it. Now, let's talk about the timing, because the 60s has a lot of important things happening, and Jack Kirby was tuned in to what was happening in the world. In 1961, we had the Freedom Riders, which were young people mostly and others who cared about civil rights who were trying to desegregate buses across the South. And so they would ride what should have been a segregated bus per Jim Crow laws, and they would get beaten up by police for it. And this goes on for 18, 24 months. And it's a huge ordeal, and a lot happens, but it's one of the big battles that we have in the civil rights movement. In April of 63, we have the economic boycott of Birmingham, Alabama, that Martin Luther King and others organized to fight segregation in Alabama. King was arrested during this, and this is when we have the letter from the Birmingham jail cell. In May of 63, we have horrifying images on TV of children who go out and march, and Bull Connor was a vile human being who unleashed fire hoses that could peel the bark off of trees and German shepherds on these kids. And the footage shows kids with shirts getting blown off, launched into cars. It is utterly horrific. And as President Kennedy said, Bull Connor did more for the civil rights movement in getting the Civil Rights Act passed because he was a horrible human being who went out and tortured others. And that footage, that moment of 63, had to be things that people in the Marvel bullpen were watching, because the change is coming up in Axeman very, very quickly. In June of 63, we have Medgar Evers, who was murdered. If you're not familiar with that civil rights leader, read up on him. He's an amazing human being who was registering people to vote and fighting the good fight, and he was executed in his front yard coming home from work. Kirby's birthday was August 28, 1917. On his birthday in 1963, Martin Luther King gives the I Have a Dream speech at the Washington March. And that had to have some impact. His family hasn't written about it, but what was the dinner time conversation on his birthday? What meaning did that have? Because X-Men came out in September, days later. You have church bombings in the South. We have Congress stepping up, and we have the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then we have the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And these are things that have to be discussed in New York City as they are writing these comics. Because the laws that we pass are to fight cruelty. If you don't know what these acts are, and that's okay, but these say you can't discriminate against people in hotels and restaurants because of the color of their skin, that you have a right to be able to go to places in public accommodation. These are the things that we see in great detail during Claremont's era on the X-Men in the 80s. But this is the beginning of that. This is that march that took place and the impact that it has on the comic creators. Because in issue 8 of the X-Men, which is in November of 64, we see mutant persecution beginning. Beast saves a child. And he's in civilian attire, so everybody sees him, and things get nasty. We'll break down all the vileness, but people turn on him, thinking like, well, he's obviously a threat, and he's just been trying to play along and make us think that he's okay. And they get ugly. They chase Bobby and Hank down.
Bobby's they ruin his purple suit.
A magnificent purple suit. Few people can pull one of those off, and they ruin it. And Hank is manhandled and ripped up, and he has a bad day, and he leaves the X-Men temporarily because he is so horrified about what happened to him. And Mike, why don't you talk to us about riots and what we can learn from this comic?
You know, it's great. As we saw when we were looking at Captain America, Captain America came out before the war happened. X-Men came out before the Civil Rights Act was passed. A lot of people accuse comics of being just propaganda for the government to get people behind the war effort or some effort. This is a case of the exact opposite. This is somebody wanting the government to get behind something he thought was right. Now, looking at this rioting statute, this is the kind of statute that attorneys salivate over, because there is so much wiggle room in this act. First, it's second-degree rioting. That implies there's first-degree rioting, perhaps third-degree rioting, involuntary rioting. So what is that, and why four people? Is it if one guy is out there throwing rocks, it's like, bless his heart, this is Jimmy being Jimmy. Jimmy's out there with his buddy Bobby. Others are just drunk guys out there throwing rocks. Suddenly we get to four. Now we have a riot on our hands.
Now it's a problem.
Yeah. Then it has to happen simultaneously. Is that like synchronized swimming simultaneously? It's 5, 6, 7, 8, we throw the bottle. Can I show up 5 minutes late to the riot and still be accused of rioting because I'm not there simultaneously? That's something to argue about too. And what's tumultuous conduct? What's public alarm? In this case, if you look at the slides, you start counting. 1, 2, 3. We have 4 people, we have a riot. And once again, we have that great Kirby illustration of the fist coming from a other scene through the page and coming almost off the page at you. It's that Kirbiness that he's really known for, that dynamicness. Public alarm. It's supposed to be something that makes the public do something. It could be as small as someone had to cross the street to get away from you. That's public alarm. Tumultuous conduct. That's supposed to be mob behavior elevated to the point of throwing rocks, getting in a fight. It's not just meant to be merely loud noise. So do we have a riot on our hands? We have 4 people. The first person talking, calling him a gorilla. Just racist. Second person, I think they're going to take over the world. You're just being a jerk. It's that last one when it's, let's get him. We now have a riot on our hands. And I think Beast would agree.
Let's get into deep mutant persecution, which comes about in issue 14, where the Sentinels are introduced. Now, Lee did the story, Kirby did the layout, and Jay Gavin did the art. Now, we don't have comic book forensics to figure out exactly how much layout Kirby did that then Gavin filled in. We included this because Kirby definitely worked on it. You see some Kirbiness to the story itself, but it's different because he definitely worked on it, but Jay Gavin also worked on it as well, and so there's some differences here. Now, we have outright racist propaganda coming out of Trask with mutants walk among us, hidden, unknowing, waiting for their moment to strike. Change the word mutant to any nationality, race,
religion,
anything. And that's why this is super disturbing. You can't write a comic where you pick a name of a race because people won't publish it. But when you say mutant, you can highlight cruelty and racism. Rod Serling did it with the Twilight Zone, and Kirby, Lee, and those at Marvel did it with comics and being able to highlight what persecution is and the overtones that are happening in 1964. So there's outright fear-mongering. So you have somebody who is an anthropologist saying that we have a new race of humans, they're going to subjugate us all, they're a menace, and don't worry, I'm an anthropologist, and we've created artistic renditions of our repressed future where this master race comes along and enslaves all of us. And they're just printing this in the paper, and he's going on TV saying all these horrible, vile, racist things. It's like your family member who watches a certain news channel that just starts saying racist things about people.
Leave my dad out of this.
Yeah, my grandpa, too. And that's what's happening with the mutants. Well, the anthropologist somehow builds a robot army. Who funded this dude?
We looked on glassceiling.com, and the starting salary for an anthropologist is $54,000.
This just
added his engineering training, obviously. And it's going to be a little more than that.
And advanced AI, because these things think and can go, hey, don't be alarmed. Me as a private individual, I've created killer robots to take care of the mutants. Imagine someone's doing that, but using any other race, nationality, religion. The reaction we would have would be veins coming out of our necks, and we would be lining up protesting, because that's evil. And Professor X demanding to go on TV and debate him is what the First Amendment's about.
And now, if 4 or more of us go, we could riot.
Yeah, Beth. We're going to peacefully resist. Now, naturally, since the comic, everything naturally goes bad. So the killer robots turn on the humans and, you know, capture their creators so they could go make more. And in true comic book fashion, the X-Men are asked to go out and save the world from the killer robots that were supposed to go out and kill them while they're being discriminated against. So it's like, thanks! We totally value being used this way. And that's what they do. Now, Kirby, Lee, and everyone at Marvel also believe in human redemption. So Trask starts out horrible racist. He's then being used to help take over the world, and he doesn't like it, and he sees the X-Men fighting to stop the monsters he creates. And Trask gives his life stopping Master Mold from making Sentinels to take over the world. He has the complete realization that I was wrong. I was a bigot, and I have to die stopping this. And it actually ends with this quote, "Beware the fanatic. Too often his cure is deadlier by far than the evil he denounces." And so Trask redeems himself, and that's important, but it's done in secret. Nobody knows of his sacrifice. And that's borderline Greek tragedy.
Also, nobody knows if he got a patent on these things.
And
was he going to sell them?
Which brings up all kinds of issues that you have a private individual building killer robots to terrorize U.S. citizens based on their race, to put them in camps. We've heard that story before. There's no government action yet. So what was his end game? To sell these to the government? So there are issues with this, and let's talk about if he had sold these to the government and the government was using Sentinels to round up U.S. citizens based upon their race or just kill them, what's the legal realities of that?
Not okay. That would be the legal reality. You know, the Sentinels killing mutants anyway is not legal. You've got no crime. They've committed no crime. They haven't been arrested. There's no probable cause. There's no right to counsel. There hasn't even been a trial. You know, arguably, mutants are people. They're just a little different from the normal person, you know? And the Sentinels can actually somehow sniff out regular people who will eventually breed these mutants. You know, they're born of humans. Most of them look like humans. You know, there's just a genetic difference. You know, my eyes are blue, my mother's eyes are green. So at most, I would think a mutant, it might be a medical condition. And if it is, the United States Supreme Court has said that you cannot punish someone based on a medical condition. It's actually a violation of the cruel and unusual Eighth Amendment. Dan?
All right, by show of hands, who here thinks mutants are humans? Okay, I'm going to have to race a lot of people out of here because you're all wrong. Go back to Josh's first slide when he talks about what is the mission of the mutants. And he says there are mutants out there that want to end the human race.
There are people out there that want to end.
Yeah, that's a political opinion.
So this is the head person for the mutants saying we are not people. We are a higher species. If you look at what Professor Xavier believes is we're not that different than you, therefore you shouldn't fear us and leave us alone. Then you have Magneto. We are completely different than you. You should fear us, and that is why you should leave us alone.
Yeah, so one gene is the difference. They have the X gene, and that causes them to either grow wings or get blue and furry. They're different. People are different in height. Humans and mutants can interbreed. Yes. Orangutans are 98% genetically the same as human beings. Orangutans don't have civil rights because that 2% difference is enough to make them a completely different species.
Well, let's talk about the theory of the Frankenfish.
Let's talk about speciesism.
This is a farm-engineered fish that is superior to all of the other fishes around. It's bigger, it's stronger, it escapes into the wild. It can breed with the other fish because it is bigger and stronger. The other fish don't want to breed with the current fish. They want to breed with the frankenfish. Pretty soon, we have an invasive species that has taken completely over the population, and that's what we have happening. If you look at the plot of X-Men 2, you have Magneto eventually is able to control Professor Xavier in the Cerebrum. What does he do? He says, target all the humans. If mutants were humans, everybody would be targeted and die. Because they are not humans, it's okay, we're getting rid of an invasive species. It's not just a medical condition.
It's like hair color or eye color. And in the 19-teens, there was this racist movement to scientifically prove the races that were inferior to those from Europe. There was craniology, where they would measure foreheads and say, well, the large sloping foreheads of those from Italy are racially inferior to those of white people from Middle Europe. And they did the same for if somebody was from an Asiatic country. So pseudoscience has been used to scapegoat, persecute, and a reason to discriminate against people for at least 100 years. And that should not be a reason to discriminate against mutants. Just because Angel has wings and can fly does not make him any less of a human being subject to civil rights.
And a frankenfish is still just a big fish. Breeding with other fish.
Yeah. And if Magneto had his way, we're not less than human. We are more than human. We are the next phase. You are the Neanderthal. It's time for you to go.
And luckily,
we don't want to go. Therefore, we must get rid of the mutants.
Yeah, and we saw how
go
that war
Sentinels.
Ended. I cite the Potsdam surrender on. We took care of that one. Well, let's take a look at whether or not Sentinels could be used like drones. Because they're not manned by a person. They are manned by AI to go out and recognize those who have the mutant gene and eliminate them. So the DOJ memo on the use of drones to kill Americans overseas working with Al-Qaeda has a multi-part test. Part one, an informed high-level U.S. official has to say the targeted individual poses an imminent threat of violence. Capture is infeasible, and the use of the drone would be consistent with applicable laws. Well, the problem with going, we're going to unleash the Sentinels to take out all the mutants, is pure racism. It's saying anyone's a mutant is a imminent threat to the United States. That's like saying anyone who isn't white is an imminent threat to the United States. And that's not legal. It's pure racism, and it's why the Sentinels in any comic would not be legal. But let's jump to the Fantastic Four. And that wonderful issue of the Skrulls try taking over the Earth, because that's what Skrulls do. And the Fantastic Four stops them, and they're given a couple options for punishment. And they opt with, hey, we'll turn into cows, and you hypnotize us, and we'll just think that we're cows. Is that cool?
I think it's cool. I'm pro-cow.
Well, let's talk about the Eighth Amendment issues. Oh, yeah. If the cow ends up as a burger at some point in time.
The Eighth Amendment provides for a ban against cruel and unusual punishment, and that is defined as torture, degrading punishment, or punishment that's too severe for the crime. I mentioned before that you can't punish someone for a medical condition. That's the Eighth Amendment ban against cruel and unusual punishment. So when you decide if turning into a cow is really that bad, I pulled up a couple of cases that we should consider to decide whether or not becoming a cow is that bad. The Supreme Court of the United States has decided that it would be okay to shoot a criminal instead of hang him. You just can't burn him alive. That would be cruel and unusual. State enforced sterilization, not cruel and unusual punishment, and in fact, was last done in 1981. There was a case in the 60s, this poor criminal, they sent him to the electric chair, and it didn't work the first time. Went back to court to decide if it would be cruel and unusual punishment to do it again. Not cruel and unusual punishment. Fry him again. So they did.
Imagine trying to put Wolverine in the electric chair, where he's sitting there like, nope, regenerates again. We're going to have to find some other way in which to...
When you consider these other things that are considered not cruel and unusual punishment, I think I'm pro-Cal all day.
I think it's like giving somebody a frontal lobotomy, which used to happen, and in order for someone to have a medical procedure that reduces them to an invalid, incapable of thought.
Have you seen the happy cows in the commercial making that milk?
That's why it says they're the most contented creatures on earth.
Yeah, I'm still thinking that's up there with a frontal lobotomy and would be cruel and unusual punishment.
And yeah, they did accidentally get turned into burgers.
The way I look at it, you think about, is it dehumanizing?
It's cowanizing.
So this would be descrollerizing, which is a cool name for a DJ. But it's taking away what makes a person a person. And in this case, you're taking away everything that makes a scroll. And that's where I think it would fall on, maybe not, yeah, it's unusual, but it'd also be cruel.
Let's talk about The Submariner, created by Bill Everett, who also created Daredevil. And we see him in Fantastic Four. Human Torch finds him. Namor gets his memory back, goes to Atlantis, and finds it's been destroyed because of nuclear testing. He's a wee bit upset and declares a war against the surface world because you destroyed my home with nuclear weapons. Now, he admits the humans did it unthinkingly with their accursed atomic tests. The world didn't know Atlantis existed, are bad, but imagine if a nuclear weapon was used and inadvertently blew up all of Guam, and that country didn't intend to blow up all of Guam, but did on accident. Would that be an act of war?
It lacks the intent, but he doesn't seem the kind of guy that's going to ask permission. The issue is he should have asked permission because there's a lot of benefits to doing so. Think of it like a trial, in which case he's the plaintiff and he's saying, I've been wronged, and then he goes to the world, it'd be the UN, or in the case of the United States, the president going to Congress saying, I need justice, I need to be able to go to war to do it. If he would have done that, one, if he loses, he can be a POW, and he's not just an aggressor. And whenever you go to war, just don't think about country A and B, because it's really about country C through Z, because they're going to be your allies. They're going to be people you want to trade with. And if you strike first, the rest of those countries might turn against you. And what you thought would be an easy win, suddenly everybody's aligned against you. So in this case, he's eventually stopped by the Fantastic Four. If he'd done a full declaration, explained his case, he might have had other superheroes on his side instead of fighting alone.
Also, if you went to the American press and said, you guys blew up my kingdom, you destroyed my homeland, and all of my people are now refugees, for the most part, we're really good people, and we would freak out if we found out we accidentally destroyed a country. And we would launch foreign aid and do all that we could to rectify the situation, because we're generally the good guys and want to fix bad things from happening. Well, let's talk about the Hulk. Now, I forgot about this, but in the first issue of the Hulk, there's a guy named Igor. Igor turns out to be a Soviet spy. When Bruce Banner, who's been super safe with trying to do his gamma bomb test, sees Rick Jones driving out onto the test field, Banner tells Igor, stop the test, I'm going to go get that kid. And Igor's reaction is, I'm going to let him die. I can then go get the state secrets. Do you think the Soviet Union's liable for the Hulk because of Igor?
Not for the Hulk, maybe for attempted murder. But the problem is, how foreseeable is it that you're going to get a Hulk out of this whole experience? There's not been a Hulk before. not really been a Hulk after, unless you consider the Thing to be a ripoff of the Hulk. So that's not foreseeable, because usually it's, if I throw a rock at somebody, I intend to hit him with a rock. If I miss and break a window, I'm responsible for the window, because I could foresee that happening if I miss. In this case, they miss killing him, but it's completely unforeseeable that a Hulk is going to come out of this.
Which is the same with U.S. liability for creating the Hulk, because it's our weapons experiment that irradiates Banner that turns him into the rage-filled monster. We have case law where people have sued in Nevada after atomic weapons testing for broken windows and cracked houses, and they lose because the government's not waiving sovereign immunity for their weapons test, and there's no recovery if your home's damaged from a weapons test. So the Hulk is the result of a weapons test, and I don't think the United States government's going to waive sovereign immunity on that one. But let's talk about Banner and the insanity defense for the actions of the Hulk.
That wasn't mine.
Oh, I think it's mine.
Well, the very first Hulk that we're dealing with this on this slide, because there's been many, many versions of it, is he's vaguely aware that he's the Hulk when he's doing things. And to plead the insanity defense, you have to not know right from wrong. And in these early issues, it looks like he kind of does. In which case, that would kind of defeat the insanity defense, because what he's knowing he's doing is wrong. He just can't control himself when he's doing it.
Yeah, he wakes up with the torn clothes and apologizes.
Yeah. But I think there is a good argument because there's diminished capacity. Banner isn't in control. The Hulk is only mildly aware of his existence as Banner, and also is not happy about it. You know, his reaction to seeing a picture of Banner is, I know that face, take it away. So he doesn't want to be Banner. So I do think there's a good argument there, but in the 50 years that we've had the Hulk, there are many, many, many versions of Smart Hulk, Dumb Hulk, Medium Intelligent Hulk, and it's all over the map.
Yeah, because there used to be to be able to use Irresistible Impulse as part of the insanity defense, and what's more irresistible than Hulk Smash? He can't help himself.
We all love it.
That defense is pretty much gone now. Yeah. You're all responsible, even though you think you're forced to do it.
So with that, thank you. We are back tomorrow with Circuit Judge John Owens from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to talk legal issues in Star Wars at 11:30 tomorrow morning. So the law will be with you, and we will stick around for questions. We're right at the end. Thank you all for talking about con law on Saturday night.
Thank you all for coming.